AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about American politics, what else is new, but looking at it from the vantage point of the political left, an area of the political realm rarely discussed in the first person in U.S. news media or on public affairs programming. So we'll have a chance to do today with two people who have been longtime stalwarts of progressive politics in the United States, Mike Albert and Bill Fletcher. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. On Thursday, the Federal Communications Commission proposed new rules protecting net neutrality, the fundamental principle that prevents internet service providers from discriminating against online content and applications. The new rules are now open for public comment until March, after which the commission is expected to finalize them. The FCC vote was hailed by consumer groups, Capitol Hill leaders, and internet companies. But the run-up to the FCC meeting saw an intense lobbying effort by phone and cable companies to derail the new rule. The leader of that effort, Chief AT&T lobbyist James Ciccone, went so far as to send a memo to the company's employees asking them to personally weigh in against net neutrality. Alex Chasick is a blogger with The Consumerist, an online resource for consumer advice and issues.
A Consumerist email box got a tip from a reader who was an AT&T employee saying that he had received this letter from, you know, the higher-ups at AT&T, Jim Ciccone, their VP for Legislative Affairs, basically asking employees to use their personal email addresses, kind of obscuring that they work for AT&T, and to go onto the FCC's net neutrality website, openinternet.gov, and leave comments attacking net neutrality and saying, I'm a citizen of the country and I oppose net neutrality for the following reasons. And of course, there's no real good reason to oppose net neutrality, so they provided talking points about how it's bad for ISPs and business and innovation and all of that.
The talking points were quickly skewered by Chasick and others. The letter asserts, among other things, that net neutrality rules would exempt companies like Google while burdening a company like AT&T. But to compare an internet service provider with a search engine or content provider like Google is mixing apples and oranges.
These companies are controlling who can access content. You know, they're the companies that consumers have to sign up with to be able to access a site like Google. Google provides the content. They don't necessarily provide the means to transmit or connect to the content.
AT&T's deceptive approach, which apparently did not derail the FCC, was criticized widely in the blogs and the press. And Chasick feels this is an issue that resonates clearly with consumers, too.
The ISPs and the phone companies are really good villains. They really have just done such terrible things in customer service over the years. You know, stories of Comcast scheduling an installation and making you take a day off of work, and they never show up, and then they bill you for a cancellation charge for missing your own appointment. And so I think the idea of these companies who can't even get their own text out there on time dictating what you can and cannot access, I think just really infuriates people.
You can read The Consumerist's blog at consumerist.org.
Help may be on the way for beleaguered community television stations across the nation. Representative Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin has introduced a new bill in Congress, the Community Access Preservation Act of 2009, to help address some of the challenges faced by public education and government TV channels, collectively known as PEG channels. Baldwin got involved after witnessing the decline of public access stations and services in Wisconsin following the passage of a statewide video franchise law. Helen Soule is the executive director of Alliance for Community Media. She says that what happened in Wisconsin is also happening across the country.
There have been discriminatory treatment of PEG channels. They also are suffering with the unnecessary limits on the use of PEG funds, that the PEG funds can only be used for capital costs as opposed to operational costs. Buying the equipment is certainly only one step in creating a center that serves the community. You need people, and you need training, and you need lots of things that the funds could not be used for.
The Community Access Preservation Act, H.R. 3745, allows franchising funds to be used for operational costs as well as capital costs. In addition, the bill calls for PEG channel quality, functionality, accessibility, and placement to be equivalent to the video provider's local network affiliate commercial stations.
Some have moved the PEG channels up to the 900s, or in effect way away from the basic tier, which the intent of the law was always that these community media channels would always be where anyone who even had the most basic of cable service could get them and could see them.
The new bill would also make cable television related laws and regulations applicable to all landline video providers. Currently, cable companies and other video service providers, like phone companies, are operating under different regulations.
While there have been some rulings in some district courts saying that, no, they are cable service, we wanted to clarify it in the law that basically all video services delivered to the home over a wire would be defined as cable service.
For more information about the Community Access Preservation Act, go to alliancecm.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, October 25th, 2009. And before we go to our guest today, I do want to say thank you to all of you who contributed to the pledge drive last week. We had a rousing show of support. I don't have the final numbers in quite yet, but there were many, many, many dozens of you who made very generous pledges, and we'll be getting the premiums out to you as soon as possible. And those of you who did pledge, trust me, you have no idea how much your support for this program and for this station is appreciated, not only by me, by my friend John Nichols, who sits in with us on those pledge drives, but by everyone who works at the station and all the volunteers at the station. So, again, thank you from the bottom of my heart. What I want to do now is go to today's guest. We have on the line with us two people who've been on our program before, two stalwarts, if I may say so, of progressive politics in the United States for many decades, Michael Albert and Bill Fletcher Jr. For many of you, they'll need no introduction. Briefly, Bill Fletcher Jr. has been a journalist and activist, very active in the labor movement for decades. Mike Albert has been a journalist and activist as well, active with ZNet and Z Magazine for, again, decades. And they are active now in trying to rethink, reformulate, re-energize the political left in the United States in 2009 and going forward. Mike, Bill, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for being on. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And we're going to do this juggling because you're both on different phone lines, so we're going to be playing tag team talk today, and then we'll have some callers later on, too. We're all basically of the same generation, people who grew up and came of age either in the 60s or early 70s or a combination of both. And, you know, I'd just like to start, if I could, first with you, Mike, then with Bill, to talk about sort of your sense of the moment we're in politically in the United States today and how it is similar or different from what we've gone through and our listeners have gone through for the past 20 or 30 years. And Mike, why don't you go first?
Well, I don't think it's as different as a lot of people seem to feel, because I've thought that there's been huge potential for a long time now. Now it's maybe more evident. The trouble is the potential rests on whether or not people have a sense of hope, have a sense of efficacy, have a reason to believe that by engaging, by becoming active, something good will come of it. And I've felt for a long time that that's been the sort of impediment. The feeling of cynicism blocks people from doing things, whereas with participation, things can get done. I don't think the problem has been, people realizing that there are problems, that there's pain and suffering. And now it's totally obvious that everybody knows that there are problems and pain and suffering. So it seems to me the other thing is the obstacle, and that if we can overcome that obstacle, we can start to move forward, perhaps dramatically.
Bill Fletcher?
While I agree with Michael, I'd say that this is a weird moment, because I've been talking a lot about the convergence of three crises that make this very unique. An economic crisis, an environmental crisis, and a crisis of the legitimacy of government. And these three things are coming together, which makes this more complicated than just a situation of going through a devastating recession. It's something that where, in fact, many people are looking for radical answers, which I think is actually incredibly exciting, and I'm sure that Michael would agree. But I think that it also is very dangerous in that you have the rise of this right-wing, revanchist, populist movement that I think that many people aren't taking very seriously. I mean, when you have groups like this group called the Oathers, O-A-T-H-E-R-S, that is trying to enlist military veterans and members of the police departments to basically swear an oath to protect the Constitution against Obama, I think we have to understand what we're up against.
Yeah, Michael, do you want to add on to what Bill just said?
I mean, I don't so much disagree with that description of now as thinking that it's really not that new. There have been, you know, right-wing threats and right-wing organizing, surely under Reagan, surely, you know. I think what might be different is the potential to break through, the willingness and the receptivity of people, you know, if they're offered something, if something exists that they can relate to, and that's what we haven't provided. So I don't disagree that it's a knife edge point. You know, things can go either way. I'm not so sure that's new, but it's true. And it is very much up to us, that is, up to those who already have a view and a commitment to induce other people to join us. And that's hard work, but it is what has to happen.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Michael Albert, who you've just been listening to from Z Magazine and ZNet, and Bill Fletcher, who spoke right before him, the executive editor of The Black Commentator, a longtime activist. They're going to be here for the full hour talking about progressive politics and the state of the left in the United States today. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Bill Fletcher or Michael Albert or both of them, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So please do call in if you'd like to. And, you know, I think one of the things, Bill and Michael, I know you've both been concerned with this, but Michael, you've really done a lot of work in this, is that in the United States, and I'm a teacher and I talk to students a lot, when the idea of replacing capitalism comes along and coming up with a post-capitalist society, generally on the left, that's considered socialism, some variant of socialism. You know, the imagination sort of in the United States sort of gravitates quickly to oftentimes sort of a very Cold War notion of a police state with one party making all the rules and telling people what to do. I think it's safe to say an extraordinarily undesirable place for anyone to want to live. Or it sort of gravitates to just sort of an extension of sort of big government spending on social programs and high taxes, but not much else. And I know you've had to wrestle, both of you, with this sort of vision of what is an alternative to the status quo. And as we go into deeper economic crisis, it's probably going to be a question raised more and more, and you're both wrestling with it. So I'd like you to give your sense of how you respond to that question. And again, I think we'll start with you, Michael.
Well, I agree with you that it's a big issue and it lurks in people's minds. And the two attitudes that you point to, i.e., getting beyond capitalism is a trip to disaster, you know, toward authoritarianism and so on, or getting beyond capitalism doesn't really get beyond capitalism. It just smooths it out a very little bit, and then it goes back to the way it was anyway. If you believe those two things, either one of them, why would you devote yourself to social change? You know, why would you go to meetings? Why would you take risks? Why would you work hard? Why wouldn't you instead turn inward, take care of your family, do the best you can for yourself and the people who you love, and set aside any notion of doing something large, because there's nothing large to do. And that's where I think most people are at, understandably so. I don't think it's crazy. I don't think it's defeatist. I don't think it's, you know, cowardly or anything like that. It's an assessment. I just think it's wrong. There is a better system, and there is a way to get to a better system, probably not even just one. And so it behooves us to develop that vision and to enunciate it in a way that's attractive to people, and that's what we're trying to do. And I think it has a lot of hope. I think there's a lot of interest, but skepticism, you know, doubtful interest, you know, skeptical interest, but interest, and that means you can talk to people.
Well, I know you've thought a lot about this, Michael. Can you just sort of elaborate just a little bit to give a sense to listeners who find this so far maybe interesting but abstract?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does that mean exactly in terms of how the world would change if you went to this sort of society?
Well, look, capitalism isn't as hard as or as complicated as people try to make it out to be. At its heart, it's that, you know, some people can own factories, workplaces, you know, auto plants, hospitals, everything. And those people accrue profits. They take the largest share of the society's wealth, and they also make decisions. They dominate outcomes. They decide what's to happen, and they decide it in their own interest. And they really don't have much choice in that, actually. It isn't just that they're evil. It's that the system is structured in such a way that if they don't behave that way, they get screwed. They lose their position. And so they do behave that way. What's the alternative? The alternative is to construct an economy in which people, that is workers and consumers, own, in a sense. That is, they administer, they self-manage, they make the decisions, they apportion the fruits of labor equitably among everybody, and so on. And so the system that I like is called participatory economics, and it offers a particular set of institutions to deal with economic functions. They're not too complicated. At the heart, it's just that we should divide up work in such a way that we all have a fair share of the empowering and the disempowering work so that we can all participate. Our work doesn't cause some of us to become debilitated and exhausted and essentially bored, de-skilled, made less confident, while others of us are sort of given the tools and the means and the access to decide everything so that the one set dominates the other. That's eliminated, and instead we all participate in a balanced way. We earn income based on how long we work, how hard we work, and if we work under worse conditions, we get more for that too. And that's equitable. That's fair. That rewards people for you know, the sacrifice that they make, the pain that they endure, contributing to the social product. That's equitable, and it means that the income differentials among people would be modest and would be fair. Decision-making becomes a matter of self-management, in which we have a say in decisions in proportion to the way they affect us, instead of having no say at all in almost all decisions that are made by a relatively few people. These kinds of arrangements and an allocation system, in other words, a means of defining how things are apportioned among people, other than markets and central planning, it's called participatory planning, allow us to have an economy in which there aren't classes, in which people all share comparable circumstances, comparable wealth, access to the means of life, control over our lives, and so on. There's nothing impossible about this. It's no more impossible than it was to not have slaves pick cotton. In other words, for a while, that seemed odd. You couldn't possibly, you know, conduct Southern economics, plantation economics, without slaves. But of course you can. You can't possibly have households without sexism. But of course you can. You can't possibly have cultural communities without having racial hierarchies. But you can. And similarly, you can have an economy without classes and without gargantuan differentials in income and power. And that's what we have to seek.
Bill Fletcher, I know that you and your work in the labor movement especially, but also as a journalist and activist more broadly, have wrestled with this issue, and I've talked to you about it off-air on occasion. Well, how do you deal when you're talking to people who say, well, Bill, what's the alternative? Is that really possible?
The thing is, Bob, I think that part of the problem is that we on the left have to begin by acknowledging what worked and what didn't in left experiences, and particularly in socialist experiences during the 20th century. And so in that regard, we have to, you know, respond to allegations, distinguish what was, you know, propaganda versus reality, take responsibility for mistakes that were made. I think that we begin in advancing something by acknowledging what worked and what didn't. And many people still don't. They don't want to do it. And in addition, you do have people on the left that unfortunately are caught up in Cold War propaganda around socialism and communism. So I think that we have to actually deal with that. But part of what I say to people is that we're going to have to work through what the vision is for socialism in the 21st century through a combination of theorizing and actual practical experiences. I think that we have to speak to, for example, the immediate crises, plural, that are going on, and start to begin by offering alternative solutions, alternative programs that go beyond, for example, on the economy, beyond the Obama stimulus package, that really go to regional economic planning, really go towards issues of the types of jobs that need to be created. And in advancing some of these demands, you run smack into the ethos of capitalism. And I think that part of that's happening. And in an ironic way, I think that Obama's running into it. I was just responding before this phone call to some right-wing nut that wrote in to me criticizing Obama for socialism, for being a socialist. And what I found interesting, Bob, is that these folks have not a clue as to what socialism is, but what is going on for them is both a combination of a fear of big government, a big government at least that redistributes wealth, but also their own fears about their lives are collapsing, and they don't hear someone giving a credible explanation as to why this is happening and what they can do, and they tend to thus be attracted to various right-wing populist schemes. So I feel like this is one of the biggest challenges for us on the left.
Our guest today, Bill Fletcher Jr., you've just been listening to, and Michael Albert. We're talking about the left, progressive politics going forward, particularly in this moment of economic crisis and other crises as well, as we've already talked about. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Media Matters, our guest can be reached here at WILL at 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Electoral politics has been the focus of much political work in the United States recently, and culminating to some extent in the Obama election of 2008. Bill, to stay with you on this point, because you mentioned Obama and the animus toward him and his administration. How important are electoral politics in your vision of how we do political work, and where do they fit into the equation?
Oh, I think it's incredibly important, and much more important than I thought when I first became a radical. I think that electoral politics is important for a few reasons. One being that that electoral politics is the way that most people in the country think of politics. And even though we on the left think about politics more broadly, The electoral cycle gives us an opportunity to talk about alternative solutions. So on those grounds alone, I think it's very, very important. But the difficulty we have, is, as we've discussed at other times, is that the U.S. electoral system is so undemocratic as to limit people's real choices. And as a result, we've had the development of these two party blocks, as I call them, the Republicans and the Democrats, that are not parties in the way most of the rest of the world thinks of political parties, but are more like coalitions that represent certain interests. And the difficulty for us on the left is, how do we operate in that environment? So some people have concluded we can't operate in the electoral realm at all, so let's forget it and engage in various social movement-type struggles, struggles around evictions, around unions, et cetera, environment, you know, very important struggles. Other people believe that what we need to do is set up a third party and just simply recognize that the Republicans and Democrats are corrupt and just pull our flag up into, you know, raise our flag and people will unite around it. And I have tended to oppose both of those approaches and feel that we on the left have to engage a more a broader progressive constituency in developing an electoral arm, an electoral operation that can operate both inside and outside of the Democratic Party and advance many of the alternative programs that need to be advanced and challenge the Democrats. I mean, we have an election going on in Virginia for governor, and the Democrat is running the lousiest campaign that I think I've ever seen, representing absolutely nothing, and he'll probably lose. And the question I would have is, not right now, but in the primaries, where were progressives? Were we advancing candidates to really challenge these folks and to articulate a different view? And I feel that we have to do that while we're at the same time engaging in other social movement activities.
Michael Albert, you, what's your take on electoral politics and where the energy of progressives should go?
I probably wouldn't put it as central as I think I'm hearing Bill say, but otherwise I pretty much agree. I don't see any reason why one should rule out a priori engaging in electoral politics, just like one shouldn't rule out engaging in, you know, strikes and demonstrations and activities seeking to win demands. Both have their place, and they can be united, which I think is what Bill is talking about, which is what makes sense to me. Look, it's easy enough to see that electoral politics can lead to something very, very interesting and perhaps monumental. Just look at Venezuela, where, you know, they've elected somebody, and at Bolivia, they've elected people who represent real efforts to really fundamentally change the society. So that's possible. So it's not inconceivable even that that could happen in the U.S., if not now, in the future, as part of a process. I don't see any reason to rule it out. And I do see every reason, as Bill mentions, to take advantage of the arena, of the area where people talk politics. People talk about alternative possibilities and approaches and what should be done. What I don't think should be done is for us to engage in that arena and try to appeal to the mediators, the media, the party hacks, and so on, so that we look good to them. We should be talking to the population, and particularly the elements of the population who suffer the pains of society, instead of trying to talk to those other more elite sectors and trying to appeal to them and trying to look good in front of them. That's when you start to get sucked into a process which spits you out the other side, being barely distinguishable from what you were opposing in the first place. So, you know, I think it's part of what we have to do, but only one part.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Michael Albert, you just listened to, and Bill Fletcher Jr. They're both joining us on phone lines to talk about the state of the left and progressive politics in the United States going forward. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILLAM 580. The phone number here, if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Bill, you've been active in the labor movement particularly, but as you look around the landscape of the United States today, what are the movements you see that sort of encourage you, inspire you, that you are keeping an eye on, that you think are, percolating in the United States?
Well, there's quite a number of movements, actually, Bob. And in some ways, the problem is that we're less than the sum of our parts. That's the real challenge. But, I mean, in organized labor, we have a new president of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, who has been very outspoken in his critique of neoliberalism, seems to be looking to re-energize organized labor. We'll see what happens. We have at the grassroots level organizations like worker centers that have been involved in fights around evictions, around land use, around jobs, et cetera, like the Miami Worker Center. In Miami, Florida, you know, Power in the Bay Area. I mean, there's a number of organizations all around the country. You have worker centers that are working specifically with immigrant groups, and the whole immigrant rights movement has been really quite fascinating in terms of the energy that it's brought forth. We have a very broad-based, I'd call it united front around the environment that has started to emerge, and it's loose. It doesn't take an organizational form. There are organizations, but there are also individuals. And that is a very, very important development, and one that I feel is where the left needs to be very, very active in showing that capitalism itself is really incapable of resolving the economic crisis. So I actually am very optimistic. At the same time, I worry, and I worry is primarily about right-wing movements.
You know, Bill, let's follow up on that, because you mentioned it earlier, and I do think it's worth going into in some greater detail, which is, you know, we have a large military in the United States, and I think part of any progressive agenda I know of, and I suspect either of you would be affiliated with, would be a significant demilitarization of the United States over time. And every other country that's ever tried to do this has found that sort of a tricky road to follow. What is the capacity for truly authoritarian politics emerging in the United States, do you think?
Who are you asking?
I'm asking Bill. I'll start with you. Yeah.
I think that the potential is very strong, and I think it always has been. Whether or not, I mean, if you look over the last hundred or so, more than 100 years, the rise of right-wing movements following Reconstruction in the South and the way that democracy was shut down. If you look at the Red Scare in 1919, if you look at the McCarthy era, but I think what's particularly, there are two things that are particularly unnerving right now. One is what I mentioned before, right-wing populism and this irrationalist movement that has emerged. You know, these, for example, the so-called birthers that challenge Obama's citizenship. You have that. But you have something else which, for lack of a better term, I've called the neoliberal authoritarian state. A very cumbersome name, but basically the idea being that over the last 30 years, not only in the United States, but in the advanced capitalist world, there's been a distinct tendency to move to the right within the state, a tendency that plays itself out in forms including media consolidation, which you know much more about than I do, but also the definition of what is legitimate discourse. So, you know, when you think about in 1970, for example, who was defined as the left and the right, it's very different than now. The parameters at the level of the mainstream have narrowed. You have greater restrictions on civil liberties. So I think we've seen this evolution in the state that accompanies the rise of neoliberal globalization. And what I think lies beneath it is an attempt to orchestrate a global reorganization of capitalism and to crush any potential sites of resistance.
Yeah, I want to get back to that issue again, but first I want to go and talk to you, Michael Albert. And you've been, I think, one of the pioneers of using the internet and the new technologies for progressive political purposes. And I just wanted to switch gears slightly and just ask you about that work and how important and effective the internet has become in sort of allowing progressives to leapfrog the commercial news media and the corporate media in general.
Okay. Is it okay if I also go back?
Absolutely.
To...
You okay. Certainly may.
Thanks. You know, I agree with a whole lot of what Bill said, particularly when he said that the critical dimension of all those different movements that are exciting was getting them together. You can imagine having lots of different movements around all sorts of different local issues, like housing issues or issues inside of a particular firm or you know, all manner of things, each one feeling, okay, this is a problem, we have to solve this problem, and if we solve this problem, things are hunky-dory. That kind of movements, no matter how many of them there are not really challenging anything basic. They're just trying to correct individual injustices. Not that that's a bad thing. It's a good thing. But it's no wonder that they don't get together, because each one has an agenda and is set on doing it. And at various points in time, that's been the situation. I think what's exciting about the present moment is that everybody who's in any particular oriented movement, be it ecology or around racial issues or around legal issues or around economic issues and so on and so forth, you talk to them about the broad situation, and they don't see their problem as alone or as unique or as unrelated. Everybody knows that the whole system is a mess. And I really think that's true at heart. It's just that people are skeptical and doubtful about doing anything with it. So I think that there is that potential for unity if people thought that the unity could yield something.
Mm-hmm.
The right-wing threat, I don't know, maybe I'm just blind to an obvious reality, but I have to say I don't see it as being as great in one sense. That is something new. I see it as here, and here for decades. And it's the same as the idea of crisis. You know, the economic crisis comes along, and it's some gigantic new thing. Well, it is new in the sense that the crisis was hurting the rich as well as the poor for a moment. And that was original or new, or that was a change. But as far as the poor are concerned, there's a permanent crisis. You know, if 40 or 50 million people a year are dying of starvation around the world, and that's not called a crisis, but then it is a crisis the minute that, you know, that the highly rich lose a small fraction of their relative advantage, we have to ask what we mean by the word crisis. Okay, but the Internet. You know, I don't know. I think we can exaggerate and to our disadvantage, or we can use it soberly to our advantage. It's not the be-all and end-all. The problem with the Internet is largely that it takes the place of talking to people, and that is a real debit. That is, insofar as young activists think that the nature of organizing and of developing an opposition and of creating enough energy and enough momentum to win a demand for higher wages or for better conditions or something in your neighborhood or whatever it might be, is accomplished via communicating online through Facebook or something like that, that's not good. Because while it might have some short-run positive effects, because it's very easy to communicate that way, it was a whole lot easier for me to mail out, you know, an email to 100,000 people than it was in the old days to stay up all night with a mimeograph machine and then put it under everybody's door. So it's much easier. But there's a dimension of personal interaction and of developing lasting ties which tends to get lost. And those dimensions are critical if the process is going to lead any place, you know, fundamental. So I think what the real task with the Internet is figuring out how to use it for communications and for sharing information while somehow it doesn't undercut and instead enhances the face-to-face connectivity that we need as well. That's what we're trying to do at Z, but it isn't easy.
Our guest, Michael Albert, who you've just been listening to, Bill Fletcher, Jr. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our phone number here, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now to line one. Champaign, you're on the air with Albert and Fletcher.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I have a two-part question for Mr. Albert. And I must say that I caught on sort of the back part of his conversation earlier regarding his proposal for how a society could be run, where a role of individual and how an individual is compensated for the role he or she plays in a society would be modified or at least certainly run different than the way it is done now. I guess my first part question is, does he believe that, based on what we know of human nature, that whether such a society is really compatible with what we at least have some understanding of what human nature is? And that includes a lot of things such as just difference in individuals' talents, level of interest, level of desire, good and evil, even for that matter, within individuals' personalities or character. And that in such a society, what would happen to those people who may not subscribe to such a philosophical underpinning of the society?
Is that both parts of your question, sir?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Michael Albert, human nature and people who are dissidents, how do they survive in your world?
Sure. Well, it's a big question, but very briefly, of course humans differ from one another. Of course we have different talents and different interests. There are actually some people who worry about that, who think, my gosh, if I admit that some people are better at math and some people are better at lifting stuff and some people are better at singing and on, that'll be a disaster because that'll inevitably mean that we'll have hierarchies and everything will be horrible. So they deny diversity among people. But of course there is diversity among people and we shouldn't deny it. We should celebrate it. It means that, you know, we get the benefit of the great achievements of others. We get to live vicariously in part, having people do things that we don't have time to do. We can't all do everything and on. But you don't have to reward it. You don't have to, on top of the luck of being born with a great talent, whether it be athletic or musical or intellectual or creative or whatever, you don't have to shower that person with wealth on top of it and with power. You can celebrate the productivity and the creativity without creating the inequality. There's nothing about human nature that we know that that says that you have to you know, organize society in such a way that some dominate others. More, this idea of, well, maybe people aren't so good. Maybe people are greedy. Maybe people are obnoxious. Well, let's assume it was true for a minute. There's really no reason to believe these things, no more reason than to believe the opposite. People actually have multiple capacities and possibilities, and in different circumstances they're displayed differently. But let's suppose it was true that there was a real drive to be selfish. In the same way that there's a drive to breathe oxygen or to have sex, right? There's a drive to be social, selfish. Well, we know it's really not true because if it was true, we'd all be scurrying around trying to be selfish as much as we're scurrying around trying to breathe and you know, have sexual lives. And that isn't the case. But let's suppose it was. What would we do then? Would we pick a set of institutions which reward that kind of behavior? A set of institutions which aggravate what the person's question poses as being evil, and which make it even worse, and which enhance it, and which empower it, or would we create a set of institutions which try to do the opposite? Participatory economics creates an environment in which being nice is beneficial to oneself and to others, as compared to a market system where being nice causes you to finish last, to lose, to suffer, and does nothing for anybody else. It's a different kind of an institutional arrangement. What about dissent?
Yeah, what happens to the person, Michael, you know, who in this new world, in this coming world, is, you know, just wants to, doesn't like the program and doesn't like it at all, wants to be a capitalist?
Okay, it depends. Suppose we were talking about, suppose it was the time of slavery and we're talking about abolition and there's going to be an end to slavery, and somebody says, well, what happens to the person who doesn't like the new system? Well, it's too bad if what that means is that they want to own a slave, or for that matter, they want to be a slave. Because in a new society, neither option exists. You can't do that. They don't structurally exist as options anymore. It isn't anything goes. So in a participatory economy, for example, somebody who wants to buy the labor power of other people and control them as a boss above a wage slave simply can't do it. It's not there as an option. And you can't do it if you want to be a wage slave either. You can't be one. Just like after abolition, you can't be a regular slave. So it isn't the case that everything goes. But is dissent possible? Well, of course. Not only is it possible, but it's celebrated. You want an economy and a society that understands that there's no end to history, and that, you know, today's dissident is the forerunner of innovation tomorrow. So you actually want to subsidize dissent. You want to welcome it. You want to explore it. You want to have diverse options that are pursued. But that doesn't mean you pursue, say, serial murder, just like it doesn't mean you pursue slavery or you pursue wage slavery. Those things are such abominations that they're not allowed. And if somebody really wants to do them, well, then that's just antisocial. And I suppose they could go off and live in a forest someplace, but they can't be a part of a social system and violating its basic precepts.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We have a caller who's been waiting very patiently from Monticello, Illinois. You're on the air with Albert and Fletcher.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm getting more and more nervous with your liberals talking. They're talking all around the real problem, and the real problem is capitalism, is corporations. A few years ago, I read the book, When Corporations Rule the World, by David Corton. That was written, I think, 8 years ago. And everything he wrote has come to fruition. We need to get a hold of the capital, the corporations, and then the capitalism will straighten itself out. But corporations rule everything, from the Lumigan I put in my eye to keep from going blind, to when I fill up my car with gas, to when I buy the groceries. Everything is corporations these days. Until we get the money out of the corporations, out of the politicians, then we can get a grip on our capitalism. But until then, this is all lovely talk, but it's not getting to the root of the problem. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Bill Fletcher, Jr., your comments on the caller?
Well, I think that what the caller misses is the problem is capitalism. The problem is not the corporations. The problem is the system itself. We live in an amoral system. Some people would call it immoral, but it is certainly amoral system that grows on the basis of an accumulation of wealth and extracting that wealth by any means necessary. That's the problem. Now, the corporations are actually a symptom of the problem. And one of the things where I would agree with the caller, absolutely, is that in the short run, we absolutely do need to get our hands around these corporations and create greater direction, restrict them from the sort of greedy practices, the anti-environmental practices that they conduct. I absolutely agree with her on that. But the problem that I think people often miss, because we often mystify capitalism, is that you could get rid of these corporations, and then they'll come back. I mean, that's the problem. It's not just the existence of the current corporation. It's that the way that capitalism operates with this notion of the private accumulation of wealth leads to the emergence of corporations. So you get rid of the existing ones. And in a few years, we have others. Think about deregulation. I love to think about this in terms of AT&T. If you're old enough to remember when once upon a time we had one telephone company, AT&T, and then it was broken up. And the idea was that there would be competition among these different baby bells, as they were called at the time. Well, there was competition. And then what happened? Right? One after another, they got knocked down, taken over by another, and now we're back in a situation where, no, you don't have one, but you have a few that are basically in control. That's the way the system works.
Bill Fletcher, I want to ask you a question. I'd be loath not to talk about this before we go off the air, and it gets to something you mentioned earlier. It's tangential to that, at least, if not direct to it, which is you're the executive editor of the Black Commentator. It seems that the United States is really... its attitudes towards race and racism are in flux, as a general statement. You know, we're becoming a much more multicultural society. It was striking to me in the 2008 election to see the percentage of young voters who voted for Obama, extraordinary, in fact, compared to older voters, white voters particularly, I mean, here.
Right.
And then at the same time, I look at the birther, oather, 9/12 movement, which you've alluded to, and it, it seems it's almost impossible to escape the idea that this is race is a defining element of this. Everyone's white and they won't take our country back. It doesn't seem like it's even very subtle. You've been observing and commenting and writing about racism, white supremacy, as long as anyone I've been dealing with. What's your take on where this country's at in terms of racial politics right now?
I think it's fair to say that there's probably a solid quarter of this country, 25% or so, that is thoroughly reactionary. That is, that they are racist, that they openly and actively support the notion of an empire, that they're prepared to support virtually any war that is authorized by Washington, D.C., and are prepared to accept any irrational theory that reinforces their racist and generally sexist notions. So I'd say that there's about a quarter. Then I think that you have a significant percentage of the country that's in play. And that's what we've been seeing over time. Again, my source of optimism. Now, what we have to keep in mind is that this quarter of the country, the solid reactionary, and within that, that 25% is not a monolithic block, by the way. It ranges from very committed fascists to people like Grover Norquist, the anti-tax theorist. But you have in play those that recognize that something needs to change in the way that this country operates, but it's not that there's a coherent theory or narrative that people are embracing. So the right-wing core has very active proponents. These people are very well financed. So you can thus have people like Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly regularly on TV espousing their nonsense. And the left, I'm talking about the real left, I'm not talking about liberals, but the real left has precious few opportunities to debunk this in front of the major media or on the major media. So this is a real challenge, and this includes matters of race. The birther movement is a completely irrational movement. Completely and totally irrational. But what it does for its core is it answers the question of how is it possible that a black person could have been elected president? And their answer is that it was all a sham. So I think that all of this points to that when subsequent to the election, when people were talking about we're in a post-racial environment, that was completely wishful thinking. We're nowhere near a post-racial environment, because unfortunately, race is hardwired into the system, and we're going to have to extricate it.
Michael Albert, any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, I largely agree, but look at something. Bill said about 25% were, you know, horrendously reactionary. Okay, we could debate how reactionary, how racist, et cetera, et cetera. But let's take that as a given for a minute. That means that 75% that are a potential audience. In Venezuela right now, it's about 60-40. So somehow, the Venezuelan side of things, this 40% in really serious opposition to what's going on, and yet it is going on, and it's slowly breaking down those numbers. Here in the U.S., with a better percentage on our side, and way better than when they started in Venezuela, we accomplish less. So I think we have to look at ourselves. I think Bill gave also another one reason for that. It's the difficulty of communicating with a wide audience in the United States. I mean, it seems like it's the, you know, the part of the world where it's easiest to communicate with a wide audience, but it's not. It's very hard for people who have substantive things to say about society to get a hearing. So that's one thing to address. And another media, as you well know, Bob. And then another thing to address is money. Is the assets that the right, with its smaller numbers, brings to bear for its vision and for its crazy formulations is vastly greater than what we bring to bear for ours. But, you know, there's a part of that I just don't understand. The right wing can get its constituency to pony up on behalf of its agenda in large numbers and in large amounts. Churches can tithe 10%, right-wing churches. the left has a hard time raising a nickel, certainly raising any substantial amount of money, despite having audiences that are comparably large and sometimes even larger. And what the dynamic is that causes that isn't entirely clear. But I think it's that the right-wing base sees the right wing as offering something comprehensive. And the left-wing potential base sees the left wing as a fragmented mess that's going nowhere. And that contrast might be another thing that's at the heart of the difficulty of our making progress. And so we have to address these things. We have to address media. We have to address money. We have to address, you know, our inability to get together and to put forward something that's compelling and so on and so forth. The state of the American mind is perhaps the least of our problems, I think. That's where Bill and I may differ. Because I think it's a big country, and there's a lot of maniacs out there with very horrible views that would be quite open to, you know, horrendous behavior. But there's also a tremendous number of people out there who are highly, you know, humane and who are well-motivated and would be open to positive steps, seriously positive steps. Just imagine that Obama was what people like to think he is, and that when he ran for office and won, he had immediately gone on a gigantic crusade, you know, to communicate with the population and to put forward really serious positive program in a really compelling fashion. Would it have been tumultuous? Yes. But would he have had gigantic support? Yes. So the receptivity of the public is there. Our ability to communicate with the public is missing.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want to go back to you, Bill Fletcher, Jr. Now, there are people listening to the program who probably find still a lot of this talk abstract, especially if they're not experienced on the political left, and they'd like to learn more about it and what's going on and maybe even get involved. You know, if someone came up to you after one of your talks and said, where do I go? What do I do? How can I learn more? What would you tell them? What would you tell our listeners today?
Well, I would say that I'd go to Monthly Review Magazine. I always encourage people to do that. I encourage people to go to ZNet, and not just because the two of you guys are on the phone.
you know, come on, Bill. You're just...
No,
I'm kidding you.
You know, and I think that those are two places that I would absolutely go. I was just responding to something from this right-winger who was telling me that Obama's a socialist. And I said, why don't you read A People's History of the United States and get an idea of the background to the situation that we're in? I mean, there are, you know, all kinds of books for people to look at. But if someone that wants to be up to date on some of the major issues of the day, I'd say Monthly Review, ZNet are two very important. The Nation, The Progressive, In These Times. I mean, there are various outlets. I'd listen to Pacifica.
You know, Bill Fletcher, unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, okay, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
All right.
I want to thank you, Bill Fletcher, Jr. I want to thank you, Michael Albert. Both of you are taking time out of your Sundays to join us here at Media Matters.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Good luck with your work. We'll get you back in the future. And my name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank Melissa Trentz for her great work. And I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for her work as engineer. And I'll be back 167 hours with Robert Greenwald. We'll be talking about Afghanistan. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Thanks to the 974 listeners who pledged more than $147,000 over the past week to support WILL Radio's efforts to serve the region. If for some reason you did not get a chance to make a pledge during our official drive, you can contribute online anytime at willpledge.org. And again, many thanks.
Our forecast calls for partly cloudy skies today with occasional showers and drizzle at a high around 60. Tonight, cloudy with some showers, the overnight low 43. And then tomorrow, cloudy with a chance of a passing shower or two during the morning, then mostly cloudy during the afternoon and a high of 62 degrees. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and